we are absolutely dependent for our survival on plankton, on viruses, on worms, on bees, on trees, on whales and fish. We need them. They actually don't need us, but we need them. And so we don't live independent of them. And unless we learn to live in harmony with all of these other species, then we're not going to survive as a species ourselves. Terms of related is your currency.
Oh, you can spend it all you like. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Eat Green, Make Green podcast. This is Pat McCauley, as always. My guest this week is the legendary Captain Paul Watson. If you are not familiar, Captain Paul is the founder and president of the famous Sea Shepherd, which is an international nonprofit with the mission to protect all marine animals. They have a presence in every ocean around the world, and they are widely known from the hit show Whale Wars, which aired on the Animal Planet channel for, I think, 6 to 8 seasons. We talk about how an experience as a child led Captain Paul to wanting to protect wildlife, why he ended up founding Sea Shepherd, why Sea Shepherd takes the aggressive approach to protecting the seas that it does. If you've seen Whale Wars, you've seen the extent that they go to protect the seas from, you know, sinking poaching ships or sinking vessels that are fishing illegally and things like that. The immense damage of commercial fishing to the oceans, the Wild West nature of the seas despite the existing laws, why there is no such thing as sustainable commercial fishing anywhere in the world, the power of film and media for Sea Shepherd over the years, what project Sea Shepherd is currently working on around the world, the power of focusing on what we can do in the present moment versus thinking about the future, what we can do as individuals to help protect the oceans, why nothing gets accomplished without risk. Again, if you've seen Whale Wars, these guys risk their lives. They risk jail time in foreign countries and all of the above. And simply why, if the oceans die, we die. This is an awesome episode. This topic is top of mind with people. If you've watched Seaspiracy on Netflix, people are asking questions about where their fish comes from, whether or not they should eat fish. And we cover a lot of that in this episode. I will leave the links to the Sea Shepherd website, to their social media, to Captain Paul's social media as well. And you can donate to Sea Shepherd on the site. Without further ado, the legendary Captain Paul Watson. Terms of related is your currency. All right, Captain Paul, welcome to the show. As I was just saying, it's an honor to have you. And I think what you're doing and have been doing for the past 40 years is very much top of mind, given the recent Netflix documentary there, Seaspiracy. And I'm sure it shined a lot of light on what you've been doing over the decades. And yeah, so just thank you. I know you have far more important things to be doing than talking with me. So thank you for being here, and I'm excited to get the story and hear all about what you're working on.
Okay, well, thank you.
So I think a good place to start is just maybe a little background on you and how this all came to be. Like I said, I know you've been at it for 40 years, but you know, where does this whole thing start for you?
Well, I was raised in a fishing village in eastern Canada, and when I was 10 years old, I spent the summer swimming with a family of beavers. And the next summer, when I went back when I was 11, I couldn't find the beavers anymore and found out that trappers had taken them all during the winter. So that made me quite angry. And that winter, I began to walk the trap lines and free the animals and destroy the traps. So I guess I've been doing the same thing for the last 60 years.
Yeah, and when was like your first moment, like on the ocean or whenever, when you decided this is something you wanted to do? Like, how did you get in the position to be able to do what you're doing?
sort of just evolved into it. I was the youngest founding member of the Greenpeace Foundation when I was 19. And I was with Greenpeace until 1977 when I left to establish Sea Shepherd. And I left because, you know, protesting just wasn't working for me, and I wanted to intervene. And that's what Sea Shepherd is we're an interventionist group. We're now a movement, a global movement, and also established a strategy at the time, which we called aggressive nonviolence. We're going to be aggressive, but we're not going to hurt anybody. And that's worked quite well. We've shut down hundreds of illegal operations and not hurt anybody in the process. But I've always felt that the life support system on this planet is the ocean, and it's dependent upon diversity of species within it and the interdependence of the species within it. And so if we don't protect that interdependence and diversity, then that life support system is going to break down. And that doesn't bode well for our future. You know, since 1950, the year I was born, there's been a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton populations in the seas. And phytoplankton provides 70% of the oxygen that we breathe. If phytoplankton were to disappear, we die. We don't live on this planet without phytoplankton. We're absolutely, totally, 100% dependent upon the plant life in the sea. And so is most life on this planet. And but most people are completely unaware of that. It's out of sight, it's out of mind. But why is phytoplankton being diminished? Because we're diminishing diversity. The numbers of whales and dolphins and seabirds and fish that provide the nutrient base for the phytoplankton, the nitrogen and the iron, which is provided in the feces of all of these animals. They're literally farming the ocean for the benefit of us all. And so to me, it's a question of survival. And it's really not about saving the planet. The planet's going to be around here with life on it a billion years from now. But it's about saving ourselves from ourselves, really.
Yeah, and at what point did you realize, and why did you realize that you had to kind of take this aggressive, nonviolent approach? Like, at what point did you know that was the path that you had to go to have real impact?
Well, in 1975, when I was with Greenpeace, we came up with this idea to stop Russian whaling operations in the Pacific. And we were reading a lot of Gandhi at the time, and we thought that the best approach would be to just place our bodies on the line between the harpoon and the whalers. And so in June of 75, Robert Hunter and I were in a small inflatable boat in front of a Soviet harpoon vessel that was bearing down on us at full speed. And in front of us were eight sperm whales that were fleeing for their life. And every time the harpooner tried to take a shot, I would maneuver the boat to block him. And this worked for about 20 minutes until the captain on the Soviet vessel came running down the catwalk and screamed into the ear of the harpooner, then looked down on us, smiled, and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when I realized, you know, Gandhi's not going to work for us today. And there's this incredible explosion. Harpoon flew right over our heads, just barely missed us, and slammed into the backside of one of the whales in the pod. It was a female. She screamed, rolled on her side, and a fountain of blood, and suddenly, the largest whale in that pod rose up, slammed the water with his tail, and dove and swam right underneath of us and threw himself straight at the bow of the Soviet vessel. And they were ready for him with an unattached harpoon, point blank range. They fired, and he fell back in agony and rolling about on the surface, blood everywhere. And as he was rolling about and thrashing about on the surface, I caught his eye. And suddenly he dove, and he was coming straight at us. I could see the trail of bloody bubbles coming straight at us. And he rose up and out of the water at an angle so that the next move would be to come down and crush us. And as his head rose out of the sea, and as I saw that eye, and eyes the size of my fist, so close I could see my reflection in that eye, I saw something that really had a profound impact on my life. I saw understanding. That whale understood what we were trying to do. And I could see the effort he made to pull himself back, and his body began to slide back into the sea, and his eye disappeared beneath the surface, and he died. He could have killed us and chose not to do so. So personally, I owe my life to that whale. But also, as I sat there, the sun was going down, we're in the midst of the Soviet whaling fleet, and I said to myself, why are we killing these whales? They don't eat them. They kill them for oil. For high heat resistant lubricating oil, which is what spermaceti oils are used for. And one of the valuable uses by the Soviets at the time was for the manufacture and maintenance of intercontinental ballistic missiles. I said, here we are, destroying this incredibly beautiful, intelligent, self-aware, sentient being for the purpose of making a weapon meant for the mass extermination of human beings. And that's when it hit me. We're insane. And ecologically, we're certainly insane. So I said from that moment on, I don't do this for people. I do it for them. And that's who we represent. So 10 years later, when we sank half of Iceland's whaling fleet in 86, I had a former colleague from Greenpeace approach me and said, you know, what you did in Iceland was reprehensible, criminal, and unforgivable, and you're an embarrassment to the movement. And I said, so, you know, and he says, aren't you concerned about how people look on you? I said, no, not really. I mean, we didn't sink those whaling ships for you or for Greenpeace or for any human being. We sank them for the whales, John. Find me one whale that disagrees with what we did that day, and I promise you, we won't do it again.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. So basically, could you give us kind of like the landscape on the oceans? Basically, you have a certain amount of like sanctuaries and places people are not supposed to go and fish and kill marine life, but basically none of these are enforced by any government in the world. Is that correct to say?
Yeah, well, sanctuaries and marine reserves, that's where the poachers go.
Right.
About 300,000 sharks a year are taken out of the Galapagos Marine Reserve. And yeah, there is a complete lack of enforcement. More importantly, there's a lack of political and economic will to enforce that. So a great percentage of industrialized fishing is unregulated, unreported, and illegal.
Yeah, and is there a certain percentage of the ocean, roughly, that is protected?
Well, there's areas of the ocean which are officially protected, but not really protected. For instance,
right.
Between 2002 and 2017, we fought to get the Japanese whaling fleet out of the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. That's what it was called, the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. And yet they're killing whales in the whale sanctuary. So how can you have a sanctuary where you're allowed to kill whales?
Yeah.
So we finally won, and we drove them out of that, and we did save 6,500 whales in the process. But that's what we're up against, is corporations and governments simply ignoring international rules, regulations, and the law to get what they want. Right now, European and Asian fishing fleets are plundering the waters of Africa, West and East Africa, have been doing so for decades. And they're the real pirates. In fact, they're driving fishermen into poverty and forcing them into piracy. The Somali pirates are just poor fishermen driven in desperation to piracy because the real pirates plundered their resources, took everything out of it. Right now, we're working with various African countries to protect their territorial waters from the ravages of industrialized fishing operations from Europe and Asia.
And over the course of your time doing this, have things gotten worse? Have they gotten better? How has kind of the landscape changed? You've been shouting this message for 40 years that if the oceans die, we die. You know, have you seen significant change, or have we gone further into, you know, a bad place?
I think that we've certainly seen progress as far as awareness is concerned. People are certainly much more aware now than they have
right.
in decades past. But unfortunately, diminishment leads to desperation. And in fact, the more fish populations are diminished, the more valuable they become. And that scarcity translates into demand, which translates into people going out there to make a maximum amount of profit through short-term investment, short-term gain. I call it the economics and politics of extinction. There's money to be made by driving species into extinction. And, you know, the fishing industry would like everybody to believe that when you eat a fish, it's caught by, a couple of guys out there in their little small fishing boat, you know, with a hook and line, and they're pulling it in and they're working hard hours and everything. But that's not the case. What we're talking about are super trawlers, 100-mile-long lines, 100-mile-long gill nets, gigantic purse seiners, $100 million vessels that are out there, financed by large banks and corporations. That's the reality of industrialized fishing. You know, our critics would like us to, like the public to think that Seaspiracy is trying to take fish away from poor people in Africa or poor people in Latin America or wherever. In fact, it's the industrialized fishing operations that are taking their livelihoods away from these people. We're not opposed to artisanal fishing. We're not opposed to indigenous fishing. We're opposed to huge industrialized operations. You know, the millions of of fishermen around the world, real fishermen who have been put out of work by these huge corporations. And there's no reason why a fish that's caught off the coast of Antarctica, a fish called the Antarctic toothfish, which is then marketed as the Chilean sea bass, even though it's not from Chile and it's not a bass, but it's a marketing term. Why should that fish be sold in Denver or London or Paris or New York in the restaurants there? I mean, it's just completely out of balance and everything. It's one thing for a guy off of the Gambia to go out and catch a fish and take it home to feed the family and his neighbors and even sell in the local fish market. And it's another thing to haul, you know, thousands of tons of fish out of the Southern Ocean or in the Mid-Atlantic and distributed around the world to gourmet restaurants and sushi bars. It's a big, big, big difference on that.
Yeah. Yeah. And over those 40 years, have regulations changed at all on like what you can and can't do with those massive, like, you know, 100-mile nets and things like that?
In 1987, drift nets were finally banned, but that doesn't mean that they're not being used. We caught a Chinese fleet in 2015 using them in the Indian Ocean. There are laws passed, but, you know, the problem is the laws are ignored. There really is no law of the sea. I mean, it's there on paper, but it hasn't even been, for instance, the United States hasn't even signed onto it. So it's very frustrating because people will point to these laws and treaties, bilateral treaties and regulations, and say, well, look what we have, all these, but they're meaningless, you know, because nobody enforces them. Without enforcement, the law is meaningless.
Yeah. And what would you say right now? Is there one particular thing or species that is the biggest threat to us completely killing the oceans, or is it a combination of so many different things?
Well, it's right across the board, but bluefin tuna populations have been removed, exterminated by 97%.
Wow.
and they're still going after them. The northern cod populations collapsed completely in 92. The orange roughy populations off of New Zealand collapsed in the 90s. So we're seeing this ongoing thing. There is no sustainable commercial fishing anywhere in the world. And when our critics said, well, you know, there is sustainable fisheries. Yeah, if you're out there going in your small little boat and you're, you know, whatever, with a hook and line, that's a sustainable fishery. But there is no industrialized corporate sustainable fisheries. The word sustainability has been so overused. It's really just a marketing term for, wow, there's nothing wrong with this product because it's sustainable. Why is it sustainable? Because we say it's sustainable.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's the same exact playbook as, you know, what we see here with meat, you know, that picture of like the cow at, you know, the uncle's farm and, you know, roaming around, having this amazing life, and like that's the burger you're eating, yeah, when you pull up to the fast food.
Every time you see the products with smiling pigs and smiling chickens and smiling cows and happy cows, kind of thing.
Right.
I think there's one company in California that actually markets their product as happy cows.
Yeah. Why do you think, you know, people will watch Seaspiracy, people will listen to this episode, right? And they'll gain the knowledge and they'll become aware of these things. But, you know, in a couple of weeks, they're going to still order their fish at the restaurant, or they're still going to take the actions that they have done, you know, every day and is their habit. Why do you think, like, people, I ask this question often to guests, why do you think people are not able to, like, actually apply the things that we know are bad for our planet, bad for our oceans? You know, why do you think people just can't make those changes?
Well, some will and some won't, but
right.
The vegetarian vegan movement has certainly grown tremendously over the last few decades. In 1980, nobody even knew what a vegan was.
Right.
Our ships were vegetarian vessels from 79 till 99 and vegan since 99. But it's a difficult thing. You're changing the way people have been raised all their life and everything. And it's also convenient for many people. I think that it's a slow process, but it's coming around. I think that the vegan movement, the animal rights movement overall, is probably one of the fastest growing movements in the history of the planet. So it's making progress.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that front, I think like a big reason for that is media. And you guys in particular have done an incredible job over the years from like, you know, being on TV when you could, you know, early on, to, you know, a big YouTube channel. You guys, I feel like, started that like very early on, and now like, you know, your presence on social media. Why were you so aware of that, number one, at the outset, and how has that kind of evolved to get the message out over the years?
Well, I was a communications major, and one of my guest professors who was at our university was Marshall McLuhan, who made it very clear to us that what the nature of media is, that it is more important than really the message that it's conveying. So you have to understand the power of it. To me, the camera is the most powerful weapon that's ever been invented, and it's an instrument of change. So that's one of the reasons the most successful documentaries are, like Seaspiracy, like Sharkwater, like Gorillas in the Mist or whatever, are documentaries that tell a story from an individual's point of view. And, you know, somebody wrote me the other day and said, well, you know, I made this film about fisheries and it had all the facts and figures and statistics and everything, and it was much better than your film, so I don't understand how come nobody's watching mine. I said, because, you know, your film might appeal if you're writing a dissertation for your PhD, but, you know, you've got to talk to people, and people want a story. And so that's why the best way to get your message across is with a story. So when we did Whale Wars, for instance, we're giving the public what they want, drama and suspense and adventure, and at the same time telling a story.
Yeah, what would you say you're most proud of over the past 40 years? Are there certain moments or things you've done?
I think I'm probably most proud of the fact that what we started as a small organization is now a global movement. I don't have to oversee it or anything. You know, you can stop an individual, you can shut down an organization, but you can't stop a movement. And so Sea Shepherd's in 42 countries. We got 14 ships out there. There's, at any given time, there's 250 volunteers on those ships. And, you know, I don't have to control it. I just let it unfold the way it's going. And it's going really well in that respect. We have some amazing people as directors, as captains, as officers, as crew people. And I'm really very, very proud of all of that.
Yeah, that's awesome. So 14 ships, you said. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things you guys right now are working on?
Well, right now our vessel, the Sam Simon, is in the Bay of Biscay protecting dolphins from the French trawling fleet. Every year about 10,000 dolphins are killed by the French fishing industry. It's illegal, by the way. It's illegal in the EU. It's illegal in France. We're just trying to get the government to uphold the laws. So what we're trying to do is expose everything they're doing on a daily basis and keep pressuring the government to change that. We have our vessel, Bob Barker, which is patrolling in West Africa, working with West African nations to you know, enforce their laws in their waters against foreign fishing operations, against poachers. We're operating in the Mediterranean to stop poaching there and to confiscate fish aggregating devices, which have been set illegally. We have three ships in the Sea of Cortez in the Vaquita Refuge, protecting the endangered Vaquita from poachers. We've seized about 120,000 meters of illegal nets there so far. And I'm quite confident if it wasn't for our presence, the Vaquita would now be extinct. Our vessel, the Ocean Warrior, is working with Peru offshore, and we're looking at seeing what we can do about the incursions of the vast Chinese fishing operations that are taking place in those waters. We're protecting, one of our vessels is to protect Mapello National Park off Colombia, and also we're working to protect Coiva National Park off of Panama. We're working on the island of Mayotte to stop turtle poachers there. We have marine debris campaigns all over the world. You know, our chapters taking plastic debris off the beaches, but also focusing on remote areas. For instance, we took 40,000 pounds of marine debris off of Cocos Island, off of Costa Rica. We cleaned up all the marine debris on Cocos Keeling Island in the Indian Ocean, and we've cleaned beaches in inaccessible areas, pretty much inaccessible areas in the northern Australian territory. So it's completely global, but the strength of Sea Shepherd is really in our volunteer base. You know, these people are so passionate, and I've always said that passion, which is when it's partnered with imagination and courage, is what we need to change the world. And I'm seeing this unfolding all over the world with our volunteers.
Yeah, that's beautiful. How do you decide kind of what areas you're going to protect, and how do you become aware? Is it, you know, do you get calls or emails coming in saying, hey, you know, we saw this ship killing dolphins here, or like, how does that all work?
Well, our partnership program, we started that in 1999, working with the Galapagos National Park in Ecuador. And since 2015, we've had invitations from, which we've started partnerships up with Peru, Panama, Colombia, Mexico, Tanzania, Namibia, Cabo Verde, San Tome, Gambia, Ghana, Liberia, Sierra Leone, so many other countries. So these are invitations where these governments have invited us to work with them. We provide the resources. Gotcha. And they provide the enforcement or the authority. And also campaigns are generated by our directors and people in those various countries. To give you an idea of how this evolves, back in 1982, for instance, I get a call from a man in Glasgow, and he says, you know, they're killing gray seals up here in the Orkney Islands. What are you gonna do about it? And I said, well, I don't know, I'm on the other side of the planet. My question is, what are you gonna do about it? And he said, well, what can I do? So we helped him set up a Sea Shepherd group in Scotland, and he and some volunteers went up to the Orkney Islands, a very enthusiastic bunch. They walked right up to the sealers, literally ripped the rifles out of their hands and threw them in the ocean, and they all got arrested and all went to trial, which we won. But we've generated so much publicity that we bought that island, so which now today it's a seal sanctuary, all because one guy years ago said, what can I do? Or what are you going to do? And so a lot of our crew members, a lot of our veterans have gone on to follow their passion. One of our former captains is now in the Mediterranean rescuing refugees. She has her own ship, which was financed by Banksy, and she's doing that. That's what she wanted to do. And I think they're empowered to understand that each of us can make that difference. We can do what we set our minds to do. The founder of PETA, Alex Pacheco, was one of my crew members.
And, wow.
In 1979, when he was on board when we went after the Sierra. So that, I think, is one of the important side benefits of Sea Shepherd, is the crew come on board, they understand and get understand what they can do, what their potential is, and then they go and do those things. And it's not just in marine conservation, it's in many others. We have people who are rescuing horses in Canada, or people who are, you know, involved with trying to stop bear hunts and wolf hunts in Wisconsin, that kind of thing.
Yeah. If there is one thing right now for the oceans that you could change, whether it's policy or it's you know, completely eliminate fishing, like, what is like the one thing that needs to change for a real difference to take place?
At the COP21 conference in Paris in 2015, I said, like, if we want to really address climate change, we have to give the ocean the opportunity to repair the damage we've done to it. So we need at least a 50-year moratorium on industrialized fishing operations. I would prefer a permanent one, but at least a 50-year moratorium to stop it. We can learn from, for instance, Polynesian cultures that they used to have this thing called kapu. A shaman would declare a bay in Hawaii or Tahiti kapu, meaning no fishing. If anybody was caught fishing in that bay for, say, 20 years, it was a death penalty. And people say, well, that's a little extreme for fishing. And no, not from their point of view. They knew that if the fish disappeared, they would die. It was a question of survival. So, but there are no kapu areas anywhere in the world today. Rayathon, which is a fish finding company, the motto of their instrument is, the fish can run, but they can't hide. And that's the problem. The fish have nowhere to go. We got them in a corner and we're systematically wiping them out. And we don't live on this planet without fish. I always look at it this way. If you look at the Earth as a spaceship, which is what it is, we're on this incredible voyage around the Milky Way galaxy, and every spaceship has a life support system, which is maintained by a crew of engineers that keep everything running. And we humans on spaceship Earth, we're not crew members. We're passengers. We're having a wonderful time entertaining ourselves, but we're murdering crew members. And there's so many crew members that you can kill before the machinery begins to fall apart. we are absolutely dependent for our survival on plankton, on viruses, on worms, on bees, on trees, on whales and fish. We need them. They actually don't need us, but we need them. And so we don't live independent of them. And unless we learn to live in harmony with all of these other species, then we're not going to survive as a species ourselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, climate change is, you know, top of mind for everybody in the world right now. But there very much seems to be, and I think Seaspiracy highlighted this well, there is still like this massive disconnect to what you just said and the oceans being critical to our survival too. I feel like people more and more are coming along to the idea that animal agriculture and, you know, transportation and all these other things that contribute are, you know, we need to change and we need to, you know, shift to renewable energy and all this stuff. But there still seems to be this massive disconnect, even with governments, around the fact that we need to protect the sea.
Well, the thing with governments is that politicians have their hands tied, because if they actually try to do something, they're going to be simply thrown out of office.
Yeah.
Because, you know, doing something positive is not going to be very popular with the general population. And for the human beings as a whole, we have this incredible ability to adapt to diminishment. As things become more diminished, we simply just accept it and go on. I mean, 1965, the very idea of, if I were to tell you that, you know, in 40 years, you're going to be buying water in plastic bottles and paying more for that water than the equivalent amount of gasoline, you would have looked at me like, are you crazy? Nobody's going to buy water and pay that kind of money for it. But here we are. And as we remove one species, we just move on to another. And then we forget that that species even existed. The number of species that we have driven to extinction and forgotten that they were ever there is in the hundreds, and well, if not more. And so this adaptation diminishment, which served us well 30,000 years ago, is really a key to our undoing today, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious for you personally. I know a lot of people that are sort of aware of these things and dedicate their lives to doing something about it. It can be very frustrating, and it can be a very difficult path at times when you are dedicating your lives to these things and it doesn't seem like change is happening at times. How have you kind of just personally over the years, you know, again, you've been shouting from the rooftops for 40 plus years here. Like, how have you just personally dealt with that kind of grind of, you know, your life mission and just change being so slow and so incremental? How have you kind of kept your own personal sanity during all of it?
Well, I'm not inclined to pessimism or depression. And I learned a very valuable lesson way back in 1973. I volunteered as a medic for the American Indian Movement during the occupation of Wounded Knee in South Dakota to defend the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. And we were surrounded by 3,000 federal agents who were shooting at us. They wounded 46, they killed two. I went to Russell Means, the leader of the American Indian Movement, and I said, you know, we have no hope of winning. The odds against us are overwhelming. So what are we doing here? And he said something to me, which has stayed with me for all my life. He said, look, we're not concerned about the odds against us, and we're not concerned about winning or losing. We're here because it's the right thing to do, the right place to be, and the right time to do it. Don't worry about the future. Focus on the present. For what you do in the present will define what the future will be. That's where your power lies. You have no power over the future, but you have absolute power over what you do in the present. So that's really my philosophy on that.
I love it. I love it. Where does this come from for you? Is this from your parents? Or I know you mentioned the story growing up, but like, where does this, you seem like you've had always since very young, this desire to, as you said, do the right thing and make a difference and protect those that can't be protected. Where does it come from for you?
Well, I think, you know, it starts with the story I told you with the swimming with the beavers, but that led me into reading, for instance, stories by a gray owl in Canada who was protecting beavers in the 20s, which led me to read books by Farley Mowat and his, you know, where efforts to protect whales and wolves and things like this. And, you know, one thing leads to another, reading Romain Gary's Roots of Heaven, and it's a fictional account, but protecting elephants in Africa. And so that one thing leads to another, really, is what that was. I'm fortunate in that I've never really made a career decision in my life. Everything just sort of evolved the way it was, and I'm just continue doing the same thing. But that's where I don't worry about where Sea Shepherd's going. Sea Shepherd will go where Sea Shepherd goes, wherever the passion of the people involved bring it. Mm. And so in my hands, it's in everybody's hands now, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, and would you say you are generally hopeful? I mean, obviously you are because of what you do, or you wouldn't do it, but do you generally like hold hope for the future and see a positive future? I know you said you don't focus on the future, but do you see like the light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, I believe in the laws of ecology, that there's three basic laws of ecology. The law of diversity, the strength of an ecosystem lies within diversity. The law of interdependence, the species within that ecosystem depend upon each other. And the law of finite resources, that there's a limit to growth and a limit to carrying capacity. And when we steal the carrying capacity of other species, we diminish diversity and interdependence. What that means is that we either learn to adapt and find ways to survive within that context, or nature will deliver a verdict for us, and that probably won't be as pleasant, but we may or may not survive, but I do know that life on this planet will continue to go on, and there's been 5 major extinction events in the history of this planet. The Permian extinction wiped out 97% of everything in the ocean and 76% of everything on land, and yet what do all those mass extinction events have in common? It takes 18 to 20 million years for a full recovery, which is a blink in the eye in the age of the Earth. So no matter what we do, 18, 20 million years from now, it's going to be a beautiful planet again. We just probably won't be here. But so this is really about saving ourselves from ourselves. It's not about saving the planet, really. And, of course, also saving all those animals that we would take down with us, and all those animals and plants we would take down with us if we go down. But again, we have to focus on the present. What can I do today that's going to make a difference? Mm. And will it work? Will it not work? That's not for us to determine. It will or it won't, depending upon the way things go. But I'm certainly not going to stress about it. In fact, I think that there's really nothing that being stressed about anything doesn't really improve or benefit anything at all.
For sure. Yeah. So on that front, what would you say to an individual listening right now that does want to make a difference? You know, they're your average person working your average job and going about life, like what can that person do today to help make a difference?
I think people need to follow their passion. What are you passionate mm-hmm. about? How can you make a difference? And then use your skills and your abilities and harness it to the virtues of courage and imagination and just go for it. Not be deterred by criticism, not be deterred by, you know, influence from other people's. Follow what you, I think it was Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss, you know, do what you want to do and you can change the world. I mean, because of Diane Fossey, we still have mountain gorillas. Because of David Wingate, a biologist in Bermuda, the Bermuda storm petrel did not go extinct. Look at Greta Thunberg has accomplished as far as communicating a message to millions and millions of people. Each of us has this incredible power to make a difference if we just allow ourselves to go forth and do it. And so that's what I'm optimistic about, is that there's more and more young people all the time that are speaking up, understanding the power that they do have and are making a difference.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree. And on the ocean standpoint, right, what is the best, in your opinion, way for me personally? Like obviously, you know, stop eating fish. You know, is it volunteer and help clean up trash at your local ocean? Like, what would you say on that front?
Well, I think stop supporting the commercial fishing industry is a good start. Cleaning up plastic like that, minimizing your use of plastic, and being cognizant of everything that you do in your life. What kind of ecological impact is that having on the planet, and how can I minimize it? You're not going to eliminate it completely. Nobody can do that because we live in a system that a lot of these things are out of our control. But we can certainly minimize and mitigate as best as we possibly can. And certainly, we shouldn't allow ourselves to be overwhelmed by the sheer immensity of the problem. And that I always say that the answer to an impossible situation is to find the impossible solution, and that can be done. For instance, 1972, the very idea that Nelson Mandela would become president of South Africa was unthinkable. It was impossible, yet it happened. The impossible can become possible through passion and courage and imagination.
Yeah. And I love the idea of not thinking about the end goal, just thinking about the next step. And I think a lot of people with their passions and with what they want to do, you know, maybe it's this massive goal, but because of the scale of that goal and the size of that goal, it's so intimidating that it kind of handicaps them from taking just the first step towards it. And I think if more people can just take the first step and then the second step and the third step and just be more patient and understand that you are headed in the right direction and it is possible that, you know, the better off we'll be.
Yeah, and not to worry about the risks. Nothing gets achieved without it.
Yeah, you, speaking of risk, like, you guys have been kind of towing the line. You personally, like, your and your crew, like, personal safety-wise and lives on the line at times, I'm sure. And just, like, your on the line of legal and illegal or whatever, like, how have you guys, you personally and the organization kind of dealt with risk over the years?
Well, we accept what there are acceptable risks and then there's unacceptable risks. I mean, you just have to be cautious. We operate within the boundaries of both practicality and the law. Well, 12 years ago, I was invited by the FBI to give a talk at Quantico on what we do. And at the end of the talk, one of the FBI agents said, well, you know, Sea Shepherd's walking a pretty fine line when it comes to the law. And I said, well, really, does it matter how fine the line is as long as we actually don't cross the line? Couldn't really argue with us. We don't cross that line, but we walk a fine line. But sometimes you have to. And the risks that we take, I think, are acceptable. We've not had any crew members of the thousands of people who have participated on our ships. Not one of them has been seriously injured or certainly not killed. I was in the Norwegian Merchant Marine for a year, and we lost six crews. So I always find it funny when people say, you know, you guys are a bunch of amateurs, you don't know what we're doing. Well, I've worked in professional ships with the Canadian Coast Guard and Merchant Marine, and there are casualties, there are injuries and everything like that. So I think we have an unblemished record in that regard. And the advantage of having a volunteer crew is that people are much more cautious. I mean, they know what their limitations are.
Right.
And when people come on board our ships, they're trained as best as we can, but then they get the experience and then they train other people too. But I think I'm quite proud and happy of the fact that we've gone all these years, 42 years, you know, thousands of crew members, so many ships, so many miles, and without any injuries. And that's something I think that we can be most proud of.
Yeah, that's awesome. And how often do one of you guys get arrested or like that sort of thing?
Well, you have to risk arrest and lawsuits and everything, but we've never been convicted of a felony. And the lawsuits that we've been involved in, we've won. So, you know, sometimes you have to look on the courtroom as a continuance of the battle. You know, you fight on the sea, you fight in the courtrooms, but you go into court prepared. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons we document everything. Everything we document. That's why our film crew are really important on every campaign. We do never do a campaign without cameras because cameras not only document for the purpose of education, but they also document for the purpose of defense. You know, so for instance, when Costa Rica, when I was actually accused of attempted murder of eight fishermen, and they said that we tried to do this. We went into the courtroom in Costa Rica and just showed the film footage that was Rob Stewart who was shooting. And the charges were dismissed. I mean, it was obvious what we were doing and that what we were being accused of was a lie. So without their cameras, we wouldn't have had a hope at all of winning. You know, it's what they're saying today about, why is there so much police brutality and racism in America, right? Where did this suddenly come from? And I think a spokesperson the other day said, well, it's always been there, but the difference is it's cameras and iPhones.
Right. Right. Is there a spot right now or an event right now in the world that you've seen that is like the most, just horrific, just disregard for life? Like, is there one area where it's, the worst you've seen, or?
It's hard to pinpoint one area. Yeah. And everything, the slaughter of dolphins in the Bay of Biscay, the killing of the turtles off. There's some, it's, you can't really say one's more important than the other. One of the things I am really concerned about is the exploitation of a zooplankton or krill in the Southern Ocean, because these corporations now look upon krill as a cheap form of protein for domestic animals. About 40% of all the fish and everything taken from the sea is rendered into fish meal, which is fed to pigs and chickens and salmon and fur-bearing animals and whatever. But by rendering krill into a protein paste is where they're going. There's really no environmental impact studies being done on what's going to happen. What is the impact of taking that krill from the ocean? What will its impact be on phytoplankton? What will its impact be on fish? We don't know. And that's what really, that's one issue that's really concerns me right now, because for the most part, it's out of sight and out of mind and nobody really cares.
Yeah. Yeah. What is the best way for people to donate or help out or support the cause?
Well, it's easy to find Sea Shepherd, on the internet, on the website, Facebooks, whatever like that. And people can get involved by volunteering to crew on the ships, by being shore supporters and volunteers, or just supporting us financially. Those are the three ways of really getting involved. And also people can be involved by just looking at their lifestyle and what they eat, what they consume, and their impact upon the ecosystem that they live in.
Hmm. Is there anything we haven't covered that you would like to make people aware of or talk about as we kind of wrap up here?
Well, I'm sure there is, but also I guess I could add one more thing, is understanding the culture that we live in. It's a media culture, and that you have to understand the rules of media if you're going to convey the message you want to convey. And over the years, we've certainly learned a lot in that respect. For instance, in Russia, they had these orcas and belugas that were being held captive in Vladivostok, and we were trying to get them released. They're not going to listen to me, but I wrote a speech to be given to the Russian parliament and for Putin, and they're not going to listen to me, like I said. So what do? We sent Pamela Anderson over to give the speech. They listened to her, and they took action. So I learned that a long time ago when I took Bridget Bardot to the ice floes to protect seals off the east coast of Canada. Celebrities carry a lot of weight. So every news story has one or more of four elements. And those four elements are sex, scandal, violence, and celebrity. So you have to have one of those elements involved to get your message across. And so we always keep that in mind. For instance, back in 1984, I led a campaign to protect wolves in British Columbia and the Yukon. And we had all four elements. We got ourselves a super story as front page of the newspapers for 2 weeks in Canada and on all the TV channels. We had cameras up there like you wouldn't believe up in the Yukon. And the reason being is we had all four elements. We had them shooting wolves from helicopters, violence. We had them threatening to shoot us if we intervened, violence. We had a government environment minister that was taking, we found and expose the fact he was taking bribes from a big game hunting organization to give them what they wanted. Scandal. So I recruited Bo Derek as our spokesperson for this campaign. And at the press conference, which was packed, one reporter for the Vancouver Sun said, oh, come on now, what does Bo Derek know about wolves? This is ridiculous having her as your spokesperson. I said, well, that's not the point. You guys make the rules. We just play the game. If I had the best wolf biologist in the world here, Dr. David Meck or Dr. Gordon Haber, this would be an empty room. Nobody would be paying attention. But that, you know what? This story is going to be the front page of your newspaper tomorrow. goddamn thing you can do about it, is there? And it was, you know, because, you know, you control the narrative. If you control those, you control those elements. And that's one of the reasons C-Share for today on our advisory board, we had Sean Connery, who just passed away, but we also had Pierce Brosnan and Christian Bale and Martin Sheen and Christoph Lambert and who else we have on there too is Pierce Brosnan. So I always say, you know, we had two James Bonds, we have Batman, we have MacGyver, we have the Highlander, we have some people think he was the president of the United States, Martin Sheen. We have Captain Kirk. How can we lose?
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah, you certainly have successfully, you know, kind of woven yourself into culture and. Into mainstream culture. And yeah, as you said, with any movement, that is obviously super important. And you have masterfully done that over the years.
For example, in the Faroe Islands, you know, these guys are saying, well, we're Vikings. This is part of the Viking culture. So how do we countermand that? We get Clive Staton, who plays Rollo on the show Vikings. And he comes up and says, you know, these guys aren't Vikings. I'm a Viking.
That's incredible. Well, we're getting close to an hour here, and I don't want to take too much of your time, but before I give you the final word, I just want to salute you for the life you've led and all the work you've done and continue to do, and I'm sure the impact you have left and will continue to leave is a massive one. So I just salute you for kind of your path and all the work you've done, and thank you for all the work you've done, and just greatly appreciate it. You inspire so many, I'm sure, especially your crew and the people that work with you and around you, and you inspire people like myself to use their voice and use media and all the things we've been talking about. So thank you for that, and I will let you. Whatever you would like to say before we sign off, if there's anything else, fire away.
Well, what I always say is this is just for everybody to think this one thing, is that if the oceans die, we die. It is our life support system. And we all have a vested interest in making sure that life in the sea is not diminished. And we need to do everything we can to prevent that from happening.
Thank you.
Thanks.